sent me your Ghislaine Maxwell episode, and I listened to that one. It is a fucking great show, man. Well, thank you.
Yeah. I love when we can do, honestly, I love when we can do episodes like that when we talk about like real conspiracies and real corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And like separate it from like the wild conspiracy theories, because I think the kind of the edge that we have in this space a little bit is that we is a few things. One of them is like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, conspiracy theories are real. There are powerful people who do corrupt things, and there's always like a little, at least a little grain of truth. But at the same time, a lot of the stuff that people are believing, it's damaging them, and it's nonsense and it's misinformation. So I don't know, making that distinction, I think, is helpful. And like, it's like, I think a lot of like, you know, stuff that talks about like conspiracy theories, it's either goes all in and be like, oh yes, lizard people are real, or it goes the other direction, be like, oh, everyone who's a conspiracy theorist is stupid and there's no reason to believe it, and the world, the liberal order is just fine, no critiques, you know. So government is doing fine, the ruling class has now, they, I'm sure they're perfectly transparent. So that's no good either. But I think there's a middle ground that's sort of approaching this material.
Yeah, the CIA would never lie to us.
Right.
You know what I like about your show? I mean, there's a lot. But one thing that's cool is that you talk about a lot of these conspiracy theory stuff, but you also kind of have fun with like the conspiracy theories. Like you kind of understand why conspiracy theories are like fun. And like why people can get into them, at least on like a casual level, because you guys are kind of having fun with it too, and you joke about it and you kind of have fun. But like at the same time, there's a reason we've all grew up kind of like at least courting the ideas of, you know, conspiracy theories. They're like fun to like listen to. And that's kind of what makes the show kind of fun too. You're making fun of a lot of these people, a lot of these things, but it's also sort of like from a perspective of like, we understand it. We get it. We get like why people would want to believe there is these vast conspiracies behind like Epstein and Maxwell and all that stuff. You know, that's something I think is really hard to balance.
Yeah. I think, like all of us, I mean, all of us, at least at one point in our lives, we were drawn to conspiracy theories, you know, from a skeptical, well, because we were drawn to conspiracy theories in a very sincere way. Like, you know, I was like myself and, you know, like Julian, we remember like when, was it Loose Change came out, I think in 2005, the 9/11 conspiracy film. And we were like hunched over our computers watching zoomed up video of puffs of clouds that are supposed to be controlled demolition. I never got really into it, but I thought like, you know, it was like, woo, that was one of the first big conspiracy videos that went viral. And I thought, well, it's like, well, gee, this is incredible. This is at least worth considering. At least the premise, we understand the magnetism of these alternate ways of understanding what happened, especially big disastrous ones, especially in the face of, you know, sort of reasonable distrust of authority. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. It's like on one level, we get it. You know, we aren't saying that it's inherently stupid to believe in conspiracy theories. There's often, you know, like I said, there's often the grain of truth, and and the thing is that conspiracy theories at base, they're stories, and stories are inherently intriguing and they penetrate our psyche in really powerful ways. So we understand the draw.
Okay. Well, we should probably get the show started. Normally I would actually, you know, cut this part and just start the show, but you know, you guys said so much stuff I like. I'm just gonna keep it in, and we're gonna do something a little different, and I'm just gonna start the show now. So here comes my super annoying intro.
It's what the people want. We understand.
Yeah.
And welcome back to the House of Pod.
I'm Kaveh. Joining me today, boy, we got some special guests. This is kind of a legendary moment in podcast history. I'm very excited to be bringing together these incredibly smart people from these different areas of interest on the internet. A lot of overlap, I think we'll find. But that's like one of my favorite parts of doing the show. We're, you know, ostensibly this medical show, but we talk about a lot of other things involving public health. And I think we're going to be delving into a lot of that today. And I love being able to bring in different people from different groups to do that. So this is a very exciting day for me. First of all, let's introduce
the voices that you've been hearing so far in this conversation.
Nathan Alabach, musician, writer, occasional podcaster, the voice of the Steakums Twitter account. If you're one of the medical professionals who's listening to this podcast and you drew the line to podcast and you said, I'm never going to get on Twitter, then you probably don't know why that's super exciting, but trust me, it's very cool. And joining us also, we have Travis View, the host of the podcast QAnon Anonymous. It's this great podcast that covers conspiracy theories and all other dystopian stuff happening in the world right now. It's a really great show, and I've gone down the rabbit hole of listening to it recently myself, and I highly recommend it.
And also joining us later will be Sharky Liguana. When he gets here, we'll work him in. Longtime listeners have heard him on the show a number of times.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Nathan, it's great to have you back. And Travis, it's really nice to meet you. Like I said, I have been listening to your show a lot recently. It's how long have you been doing the show for?
We started I joined the show in October 2018. So yeah, over 3 years now.
So, you know, I'm getting caught up. You guys are at least at like 180 episodes plus. And you cover more than QAnon, obviously. Was that always sort of the plan? Like, how did this evolve? Was it just you thinking at first, we want to talk about QAnon, and then you guys covered as much as you wanted to cover, and then you said, let's cover some other stuff? Or did you just sort of spread out organically, like studying QAnon kind of led to other things?
Well, yeah, I wanted to talk about QAnon partly because, I mean, it really started on my Twitter account, which is I started under a fake name with no real intention of doing a lot with it. But I noticed basically that there's this weird conspiracy theory that was growing out of 8chan that was sort of infecting mainstream social media and mainstream sort of right-wing media in a really disturbing way. And it wasn't getting the kind of coverage and attention I thought it deserved. So I started tracking the sort of the growth and development of this movement. Hooked up with my co-host, who actually started the podcast independent of me, because they also thought it was very interesting. But we started talking about the QAnon, and then we started talking about what we wanted to do is that we talk about, like, well, here's like a wacky, insane thing that that QAnon followers believe. And we gave the example of adrenochrome, which is, of course, sort of just a repackaged sort of form of the ancient Jewish blood libel, this belief that the elites, in order to stay young or get high, they drink the adrenalized blood of terrified children. So it's like, this is obviously absurd and stupid, but we also want to talk about, well, is there any truth to it? Is there any like reason sort of adjacent to this that you might believe it? We talked about the ways in which Silicon Valley people like Peter Thiel actually did have a company called Ambrosia, which involved extracting the blood of the young and infusing it into the old, and in order for them to stay young. So this was a bizarre sort of plan. So obviously the whole adrenochrome thing was bizarre. But the idea that powerful rich people are think that the blood of the young is very valuable in some capacity, well, there's something to that. So we tried to approach it in that way, because we tried to approach it in a way that recognized the bizarre, often anti-Semitic, often very damaging disinformation and conspiracy theories and extremism that was sort of pouring out of QAnon, while also acknowledging, you know, the ways in which conspiracy theories are fueled in part by a little grain of truth that's also worth exploring.
Yeah, wait, let's get back to that little grain of truth. What was it that Peter Thiel's company was actually doing? I mean, I knew he was into like cryotherapy stuff, and like he's like one of these guys who probably wanted to freeze himself as much as possible to like slow down whatever, but this was like a real thing, like infusion of blood or something.
Yeah. He came up with this company, and it was well documented a few years ago, but he came up with this Ambrosia company. but they that sold plasma transfusions from donors aged 16 to 25.
Oh my God.
Promise of having like healthful benefits and youth affecting benefits to older people. So yeah, that's, I mean, that was a real company that marketed this. So so that's like, you know, again, this, like, again, the whole adrenochrome thing, like I said, it's a part of a very damaging and often deadly sort of anti-Semitic canard. So it's should be resisted and called out wherever it's seen. But we also want to talk about, you know, it's like often conspiracy theories come from sometimes it's just pure, you know, extremism, but there's this anxiety. There's this feeling that like the conspiracy theorist is just a powerful pawn in a big game that the powerful people are playing. And so we need to at least acknowledge that anxiety a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Nathan, you follow the pulse of Twitter and the pulse of the social media, I think, really closely. Do you feel like anxiety has gone up over years, and do you see that connected to conspiracy?
Oh, absolutely. I think, I mean, Travis would know this as well. There's a lot of data out there, both from polls and long-term studies that show just cultural anxiety increasing, you know, amidst, you know, times of just like with the pandemic going on right now, just as you would see in a post 9/11 world, post like JFK's assassination. Like, you kind of have these moments in the culture where something massive and confusing and chaotic happens. And it often, you know, sends some portion of the population into this spiral of distrust. And then, like we were talking before the show, Travis was mentioning how in large part, a lot of these conspiracy theories that kind of take on an ideological piece to them, like they have a storytelling element to them. And I think that's what attracts people in a sort of quasi-religious or cultish way, where whether it's a person or an idea or a group of people, they kind of string together, you know, this narrative that makes sense of something that's otherwise difficult to make sense of. And then that just really becomes super attractive in times of worry and distrust and anxiety. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, you know, even if we didn't have the data, I don't think you need, I mean, I shouldn't say you don't need a study, but because I don't want to be all anti-scientific, but it's pretty clear, like in a time like this, why, you know, cultural anxiety would be at a certain high and why we would see the sort of correlation with the rise of conspiracy theories and misinformation the way it has.
Right. So you both have talked and written about conspiracy theories, and you both have talked about sort of cults, the cult aspect of it. I always felt like a cult needed some strong charismatic person, like the Nexium dude, who like was charismatic and like I could see why that would bring people in. But it seems like nowadays, am I wrong? That's not even necessary. Because like, is Q the Q of QAnon? Nobody even knows who that is. It's just these, like, it could be a computer generating random words for all we know. I mean, how is it that Q has been able to amass this cult-like phenomena without being a charismatic person that we can at least see? Am I missing the charisma in his Q drops?
Yeah, I mean, well, there are a couple things going on. I mean, it's like, if you're really curious about, like, you know, the evidence regarding Q's real identity, I'd recommend checking out the HBO documentary Q Into the Storm, which the documentarian Colin Hoback, he investigated this thing for 3 years. And I don't think we have any, you know, solid answers about the exactly who was involved, but he does lay out a lot of evidence regarding who may be behind that. So that's worth checking out. But also I would say what's unique about QAnon is that it provides a kind of like a gamified experience. It provides sort of like, I guess, the raw materials for a cult-like experience. Because the premise is that instead of like, you know, the cult leader sends down edicts about what is and is not true, the QAnon followers believe that Q sends out these breadcrumbs, these little clues, these little cryptic phrases that the QAnon interpreters must decode in order to make sense of. And they often call this process baking. So this guy actually allows people to prop themselves up as interpreters of the cue drops. There's one person named who did this very successfully, named Praying Medic. He's a guy out in Arizona. He claimed that he could help people understand what the cue drops meant. In that sense, it's sort of like it operated a little bit like an MLM, you know, because it allowed people to establish a social media presence by claiming that they could help people understand what the cue drops meant. So instead of like being a sort of like a singular sort of cult leader, it's sort of like, you know, provide the raw materials that allow lots of other individual sort of franchises to pop up around Q.
Mm-hmm.
And to just to tag onto that too, Travis was saying, in some regards, there is a kind of loose leader. I mean, some people view the leader as Trump, or they'll view the leader as Q, or in even the more loose sense, some people just view the leader as God. Like, this is all part of God's ultimate plan in some way. So there's kind of these, like he said, there's this interpretive dance going on where, you know, it kind of inverses what a traditional cult would look like. Whereas traditionally you have a cult leader saying, all right, you must do this, you know, and people kind of fall in line. With this, Q kind of lays out the groundwork where people can build their own adventure out of this series of documents and this kind of loose doctrine and this community that gets built out of the ideology. So it splinters into a lot of different directions from that. I mean, as we've seen, you know, Travis mentioned the MLM sort of esque part of this. Like, obviously we've seen people come from evangelicalism, we've seen just secular kind of like run-of-the-mill people coming to this. We've seen a lot of people coming from the sort of self-help and alternative medicine crowds. There's like all these different avenues toward the sort of QAnon and just QAnon adjacent conspiracy theory mindset, you'd say.
All right, so we're going to introduce Sharky now. He has made it. Sharky, meet the guys. Guys, Sharky.
How's it going, Sharky?
Yeah, pleasure meeting you.
Hi, guys.
All right. So we were just talking a little bit about the conspiracies, why people believe in them, the cult-like figures behind them. And, you know, one thing that, Nathan, you wrote about that I think is really interesting is that these people that are in these groups, part of why they're so attached to them is this feeling of being like in a secret group. They have some secret knowledge. They have some goal. They're heroes in some way that are fighting a bigger system. It's a real emotional response. And I feel like people who make these emotional responses, and from my perspective as a doctor, it's people who are making what I feel is a very emotional response against vaccines now. But when people have these real emotional connections to something like this, like a cult or a conspiracy, how can we break that? Can being intellectually like rigorous with just showing people the information again and again, will that do the trick? Or do we have to also respond to them on an emotional level? Does that make sense? I'm sorry, that was a weird question.
Oh no, of course. Yeah, there's that age-old quote. I don't know who said it, but you know, you can't reason someone out of a belief that they didn't reason themselves into. I don't necessarily know if that's like a for sure thing in every case. I mean, obviously there's people that are able to kind of like deconvert from extremism and religious attitudes or whatever. But largely speaking, I mean, I think there's a million approaches to something like this, but it's kind of like at a two-prong level. There's the individual level, then the cultural level. I mean, Travis would tell you, as would anyone else I know who covers extremism and conspiracy theories, you know, there's a massive gap between talking to like a family member or a neighbor, or even like taking the time to message somebody on Twitter versus, you know, trying to prescribe a culture-wide strategy via media or via government policy to kind of like curb a lot of this stuff and curb these attitudes. So I don't necessarily have a great answer on the sort of macro level, just because it's super complicated. And I think a lot of this stuff, you know, whenever people give answers to this stuff, you hear them talk about media literacy and how we need to teach, you know, critical thinking in schools. And there's obviously tons of truth to that. I mean, there needs to be some kind of institutional kind of a reform at a really fundamental and low level, you know, in terms of like starting this at kindergarten or whatever. But I think generally speaking, you know, there's not like a there's no one size fits all like magic pill to kind of, you know, deconvert someone from an extreme belief. I mean, I really do try when I talk to people about this, and I often fail at it because, you know, it's easy to poke fun and mock and, you know, talk about this stuff in a more condescending way without even meaning to sometimes, just because, you know, we're talking about absurd ideas oftentimes. But, you know, I try to be at like a relatable level, you know, try to remind myself and remind people I'm talking to that really anybody can fall for a conspiracy theory. And we've all believed a conspiracy theory at some point in our lives, or we've all spread misinformation. And I think it's easy to forget that because you kind of get into these rhythms oftentimes, you know, especially from the outside looking in, of something like QAnon, where the first time you hear about it, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, this is so extreme and so crazy. You know, how could anybody ever believe this? And then kind of creates this space between you and that person where you can dehumanize them and otherize them and act like it's this absurd thing that, you know, who would ever be stupid enough to fall for something like this? And yet we all know a person who has otherwise, you know, rational critical thinking abilities who's fallen down these paths. So I think that's like a super, super important step, both on an individual level and a cultural level. If we can get more of that kind of attitude baked in to the work of just kind of reminding people and reminding ourselves, like, dude, whether you're a journalist or whether you're a politician, it's like we are all capable of taking on these beliefs and these attitudes. And it's just, I think, especially when you're covering misinformation, because, like, dude, I've spread it before. And it's like, if you're someone who's covering it and then you spread it on accident, and then you get a bunch of people being like, well, look, you know, you're the one spreading it, you're the one doing this thing. It's like, you have to be able to kind of loosely hold on with, like, with humility to these things, because otherwise you paint yourself in a corner. Another thing Travis mentioned, this whole blurred line between conspiracy theories like QAnon versus like a real conspiracy, like something like MK Ultra or something like that. And I think, you know, it's really important that you don't paint yourself into a corner where you're so like, oh, conspiracy theories aren't real, and none of this stuff happens, to the extent that you no longer can, like, in reality criticize power and criticize, you know, areas of government and institutions where there have been corruption and there have been conspiracy theories. So all that, that's a long-winded way of saying, you know, I think a really important aspect of deconverting people or whatever is extending an olive branch and, like, learning how to break that ice when, you know, these people oftentimes are so barred down, you know, in their beliefs, and they're waiting for you to be condescending. So you got to find a way to break through that just to get a conversation going in the first place.
When talking about, like, how to, like, curb conspiracy theories, like, on a, like, on a mass society wide level, I think it's important to curb your expectations on that by reminding yourself, like, conspiracism has been with us just always. This is just something that's been with us for hundreds of years. In fact, there's this great experiment that's performed by Professor Joseph Usinski, who wrote a lot of great scholarly books on conspiracy theories. He did this. What he did was that he examined letters to the editor in newspapers from 1880 to about 2010, and he tracked basically how often the conspiracy theory was mentioned in these letters to the editor, reasoning that if a conspiracy theory was part of the discourse, then it would be mentioned more frequently in these letters to the editor. And what he found was that there were times basically where conspiracy was, like, more popular. For example, it jumped in the immediate aftermath of the JFK assassination, unsurprisingly. But it's been more or less consistent. This is just a sort of there's always a level of conspiracism in the political discourse, just always. As I often mention, the very first third party in the United States is called the Anti-Masonic Party. It was dedicated to the proposition that the Freemasons, who were in thrall of the Illuminati, were plotting to take control of the United States, right? And this was back in the early 1800s. So, conspiracism and this influence on politics has always, always, always been with us. And it probably always will. Now, that doesn't mean that it's a futile fight. Doesn't mean that like we should like, you know, allow misinformation to thrive uncontrolled. But I think you have to remember that this is just part of society. It's part of our psychology. It's part of how we operate. So it's normal in a sense. So it's something that we should, we shouldn't expect that we're going to reach a time in which political discourse consists entirely of sitting down and just hashing out various policy positions.
I've come to terms with it. Like acceptance I'm in denial is what you're saying. I need to come to acceptance.
I mean, what I say is that it's like when conspiracy theories spread and when they get popular, don't be shocked. Don't be surprised. This is normal. It's happened before we were born. It's going to happen after we were dead. So I think it's the truth matters. I think it's still worth fighting. I think it's worth directing people towards facts as much as humanly possible. But also don't be shocked when conspiracy theories are popular, because they always have been and they probably always will be.
So Travis, I think that like another way of saying what you're saying is like fundamentally our brains are organized as pattern matching machines, and we're just constantly looking for patterns in data, and where things kind of get deconstructed is where we read patterns in tea leaves, or we read, you know, patterns in events, and we want to attribute these causes to, you know, some sort of ulterior motive, because it's a convenient way of tying everything up in a unifying theory. I'd even go a step farther and say there's very little that we can do actively or aggressively to, you know, kind of move somebody out of conspiracy, you know, mode. That being said, there are some strategies that are more effective than others. It's sort of, getting people to grapple with, you know, any cognitive dissonance and sort of accepting reality. And those usually involve not being across from them, talking at them, but sitting side by side with them, building friendships and alliances coming at them laterally rather than oppositionally. But there's another thing that's happening, which is almost like a mass dysfunction in psychology, where for group cohesion reasons, we're fixating on, or some of us are fixating on solutions like ivermectin or, some of these very anti-science approaches, because it's what your group wants. And I think of that as being different from conspiratism. Like those are two very different psychological states. That, you know, conspiratism is coming from a place of not having enough information and pattern matching. The other one's really more about sense of identity and group and who do I belong with and what are my people are doing. And also, you know, how do I own the libs? And until we come up with good counter strategies, we're going to be stuck. And the last thing I'll say about that is that, you know, we think of, we think of these things as like something we can like somehow push through and persuade these folks. But the more we push, the more they react against. You know, we need better communication strategies overall. And the best place to stop that problem is before it starts. It's kind of like a migraine, right? Like once it's going, you're fucked.
I think too, just to tag on that though. So I agree that there's this tendency just among kind of conspiracy theory commentators and reporters to, it's easy to become nihilistic just about the state of things. And I think it's important, you know, even as we talk about this now, to kind of analyze some of the root causes of this stuff that can be addressed. Because like Travis said, obviously conspiracism is always going to be with us. I mean, before, even in between these kind of cultural moments, there's still spikes in, you know, interest in these things. I mean, you look at even, I was obsessed growing up with the show Ancient Aliens. I just thought it was super fun, you know, to watch something like that. And like, there's tons of I remember when I was a kid going on YouTube, one of the first, not first, but maybe, you know, the top 50 YouTube videos I saw when it first came out, was this like short documentary on the Denver, Colorado airport conspiracy theory. And now as time's gone on, I've realized that's connected to like stuff about the New World Order and all this crap. But I just remember like seeing that as a kid and being like, oh, is this crazy? Is this super interesting? And, you know, there's always going to be some part of the population that's drawn to that type of thinking and those ideas. But in mass, when we talk about this kind of society-wide spread of conspiracy thinking, I do think in large part, when we look at the sort of progression of societal distrust in institutions and experts to where we are now, where, you know, like some of these are at record lows, you know, distrust in media and in Congress. And it's like we're seeing the kind of like erosion of a lot of these areas of public life. And I think some of that, not all of it, but some of that can be addressed via public policy. I mean, it can be addressed by things like healthcare, access to better access to healthcare, you know, like reform of a lot of these institutions that have got a more communal level. You know, you look at, there's a lot of research in that's been done for decades now, the kind of like erosion of like the community in America, at least specifically, you know, like the decline in there's the I think it was Robert was it Putnam, the Bowling Alone book, I forget his name. There's like that book Bowling Alone. I think it came out in like the 80s and the 90s. And it was like analyzing this trend of how memberships in bowling alleys was declining and local Rotary clubs and all these, and then church attendance. And there's all these things that kind of interweave together and show that all these communal spaces in the US at least have been declining over the past few decades. And again, when we talk about the sort of psychology of this stuff, there's like this human need aspect of it, like need for meaning, need for belonging, need for affirmation, and all of that. But then there's also this sort of a material level of it, which is just like people need access to food and healthcare and shelter, and they need their needs covered, because when their needs aren't covered, you know, it's a lot easier to be in that state of anxiety. So like when we're talking about like, oh, post 9/11, post, you know, COVID, there's this mass and cultural spike of anxiety and uncertainty. Otherwise, even if that wasn't happening, you already still have this rising trend of distrust and rise of anxiety because of those more material factors. So there's like a couple things going on there that I think can be addressed and we can fight for at a cultural level. But those are obviously like macro things that are tougher to address, and you won't fix that on a podcast necessarily. So it can feel discouraging.
I have faith that we can do it today. I have faith. We're going to do it. This is the time, guys. Up there is their time. Down here is our time.
Battle of ideas, right?
The book was Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam in 2000. We're talking about, we've mentioned a couple times how there's been conspiracies forever, and it's something that we are finding ways to work around and deal with, and it's a constant struggle. But I do feel like there is something particular to our internet age now where information and misinformation can spread so rapidly and so quickly. And Travis, your show did a really amazing job covering the ivermectin issue, which I think is like the key example of this. And we've talked about on the show too, so I won't belabor it. And you could definitely listen to Travis's show. Also, if you want to hear about ancient aliens, Nathan, they did an episode on ancient aliens recently as well. What that ivermectin story, I think, really exemplifies is the dangers of preprint publications. And by that, what happened was, well, I'll just give this one example really briefly. In Egypt, in November 2020, the study came out and it showed that ivermectin was like the most amazing drug ever in fighting COVID. And then when people looked at it carefully, they realized that it wasn't true. Even internally, it didn't make sense. And the article was taken off of the preprint publication, but not before it got cited a bunch of times, got worked into a bunch of meta-analyses, and then contributed to the scientific data that's out there. So it wasn't like people just like saying crazy stuff like they're like someone had just made up or they had seen on YouTube. It was like, you know, there was some science behind it. It was bad science, it was poorly done science. But the problem is people do love their open access information. There is some real benefits that people will argue. Some very smart scientists and doctors will argue for keeping preprint publications. How do we balance having open access to studies and battling misinformation? Where do we go?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, especially when it comes to like preprints, I think what's happening here is that the the slow, deliberate process of science is crashing right into the hyper fast process of social media information. Mm-hmm. That I think that is causing problems, because, you know, ideally, you know, it's like, as we saw with the research in ivermectin, it's good when someone publishes a study and then makes it open to other researchers so that they can double check the data and interrogate what's going on there to see if the conclusions actually hold up. That's part of the process. That's great. But it's not great because before that extra check on the conclusions can be done, there's already a cult forming around the conclusions. There are already people spreading that information. So yeah. I mean, I don't have an easy solution either, but it's very, very difficult.
I think too, I mean, we've been saying this the whole time in some way or another, but the truth is just boring and people don't like boring. You know, it's like, hinted the Steak'em account doing commentary. It's like, I think one of the obvious reasons as to why that worked the way it did is because scientists and doctors communicating, you know, the sort of the efficacy of a vaccine or the validity of a study. And in super academic terms, this is not something that most people find compelling on just a media consumption level. So then, you know, they're looking for things like this podcast, like QAnon Anonymous. You know, like, people want to be entertained while they're consuming their information. You know, you're looking for whatever that edge is going to be to make you feel something while and I'm just as guilty of this as anybody else. You know, I prefer YouTubers and podcasters and fun articles versus over, you know, academic write-in and all that. So it's part of this whole overarching issue, but also solution. The solution is in the issue, I think, which is the fact that we've been dancing around this idea that, you know, people are attracted to narratives and it's all about storytelling, and conspiracy theories are just the kingpin of storytelling. You know, you can't weave a better story than they do because they just kind of, they can say whatever they want. They can make it as crazy and extreme as they want. But we can compete on different levels. You know, we can, you know, dress the truth up in ways that, you know, people are willing to consume. We can also, you know, speak truth to the problems that are actually happening in society, which, you know, you often get, that's also manipulated by populists, you know, like Trump, you know, who will kind of pseudo speak to an issue of people struggling, you know, working class people or whatever, but it's, you know, under the guise, you know, of some, you know, hyper extreme rhetoric or whatever. So there's obviously ways to use and abuse this, but I think storytelling is just a central part of what we need to combat this stuff, because you're not going to see the big hand of government crack down on individuals' right to produce this stuff. You know, it's just not going to happen. I mean, and even if it did happen, it's like we already see right now the repercussions of that on like scales of like YouTube or whatever, you know, people, or even Twitter, you know, people, for every account that gets banned or gets a strike against it, you know, there's a bunch that get the same thing who didn't deserve it. You know, it's like, it's really hard to divvy out, you know, the regulation of this stuff. And it's going to take, I think, a long time, a lot of trial and error between private institutions, corporations, and governments to kind of sort out, you know, how best to regulate. So in the meantime, we've got stories, you know.
I you're dead on right about stories. Actually, stories are like, it's the most powerful tool in the arsenal. Like I myself have seen, like I went online one day and I told a story about a stolen van, and 8 months later, a governor was signing my state law, you know, just because I told a story on Twitter. And you could directly attribute Governor Brown signing the law. There was a straight direct line from me telling a story on Twitter, right? And there's so many different instances and cases where somebody found the right way to tell the right story that resonated. And, you know, I think that there's a hint of a clue there. Nathan, I think what you've done with the Steak'em account is a hint of a clue, right? Like getting people interested in, you know, thoughts that they would otherwise find it extremely boring. It's suddenly interesting because it's a steak sandwich that's, you know, expressing this, right? And I think, you know, one last thing, I want to make a confession about these academic journals and preprints. just like everybody else suffering through a pandemic, I've been like pouring through all this, becoming a, you know, glorified amateur epidemiologist, glorified amateur sociologist, reading all this stuff. I think I'm a pretty sophisticated reader of academic literature, and I have to confess, I probably understand 10 to 20% of what I'm reading at best. And I think that's an illusion that these preprints give. You read the abstract, or you read the conclusion, or you read one sort of, you know, piece of the data, and you think you have some understanding of it. You're missing a lot.
That's nothing to, you know, feel bad about. These things are hotly debated amongst, you know, scientists and doctors. A recent paper came out looking at the VAERS data, the adverse reporting system, and it was kind of, you know, my opinion, a bad paper, because it misused the VAERS reporting system. But that was something that was a difficult discussion to be had amongst a bunch of doctors, and who are people who are like studying like pediatric cardiology. You know, we needed experts who actually knew specifically about the reporting system to come on and talk to us and tell us what was going on. That stuff gets really hard to do. Part of what I think we need to be able to do better is explain not necessarily the science, but the scientific process to people. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who just get really pissed off when our recommendations change. But that's how science works, unfortunately. For good or bad, science changes with the information that we're given. That's what makes us different than, say, another sort of belief system like religion, which is almost the opposite. You know, here we get new information, we make new recommendations based on that. And that is something that I think a lot of people don't have a good sense of. And I don't know what that is. I don't know if that just means teaching the scientific method, but I feel like that's something we have to explain to people. Because, you know, early on in this pandemic, you know, when we were first being asked, people would ask me, do we think masks are important? And at first I was thinking, no, they're probably not that important. But then the information started to come out. We started to see the data. We started to see that it was helpful. And I changed my recommendation on that. And that's just part of how the scientific process works. You know, I don't know how to address that, but I feel like that's something we need to be able to show Americans.
That lines up with, I think, with a lot of what we're saying. It's just, it's like we're, whether we like it or not, whether we think it should be or shouldn't be this way, the information is democratized through the internet. So, you know, everybody has access to all this stuff, not just preprints, but really any belief they want to hold. So yeah, what better way to help people navigate that in mass, you know, than how to think, you know, critical thinking, media literacy, all of that, because, you know, us trying to instill our thoughts or beliefs, even if they're the right ones, can often result in some form of backfire. I know the backfire effect itself has kind of been debunked in large part in some ways, but there still can be a sort of, backlash in some ways. We try to force people. It just comes across condescending. We all do it, but, you know, it's just like, oh, you should believe what I believe. And, you know, it's a lot better to kind of, you know, the Socratic method, asking people questions and just kind of walking them through why they think what they think. And hopefully that over time has some kind of impact on how they learn.
All right, let me shift gears a little bit here to talk about something I don't entirely understand about these people pushing contrarian beliefs, who I think know better. Maybe I'm wrong. But I want to know what the end game of some of these people like Tucker Carlson is. You know, he pushes this line of questioning, he pushes a lot of anti-vax stuff, or things that could easily are one step away from anti-vax at best, if I'm being generous. And it's stuff that I think is really hurting his demographic, his audience. And I can't understand what his end game is. Has he just done some sort of very cynical calculation in his brain, which is like, I know I can lose X amount of listeners and I'll still do great? Is it just that he's afraid of losing any sort of power and he feels this is his way to cling to it? What is the end game for people like that?
I'll jump in through a side lens, right? Because this reminds me of the difference between what we think of our political leaders as independent actors, but really they're representatives, right? And when you're a representative, your job is to articulate the views of the folks that you're representing or that you're charged with representing. And you have some slight ability to nudge the folks that you're representing, but not anywhere near as much as people think you do. So like a good example would be like Trump recently said something positive about vaccines and the crowd immediately started booing him. And that was kind of the end of that. And Trump himself has obviously been vaccinated. And so I think with, you know, folks like Tucker, with folks like Haney, Hannity and Trump, you're not so much seeing cynicism per se, as they see it as their job to articulate a viewpoint that has sprung up almost, you know, from their perspective, it's going to feel almost organically around, you know, the kinds of things they say. And so they want to represent those viewpoints. And when they go off the reservation, even a little bit, those folks let them know loudly and clearly, repeatedly, over and over and over again. And so it becomes a self-reinforcing, you know, an echo chamber. It's an overused word, but it's true in this case. And so, you know, I think Tucker, if he's examining himself, he's like, well, I'm representing these people that otherwise wouldn't have a voice. You know, is it 100% aligned with how I view things? No. But if I don't say it, somebody else will. And I'm the person they want to say it.
What do you think, Travis?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to remember that, like, Tucker Carlson, yeah, is the number one cable news show in primetime, right? And I think he got that the way that any talented marketer gets to a top position, by understanding what his audience wants and then giving it to them. Right. And I think that that's really it. It's not that Tucker Carlson is I mean, perhaps he is indifferent to the lives of his viewers, but he's being led around the nose, I think, by the audience that he's built for himself. He understands what they want to hear, and they don't want to hear, these eggheads at the CDC are actually correct on the vaccine. You probably should get it, because that would make his audience unhappy. So, I mean, I think it's really just simple as that. I mean, Tucker Carlson got into the position he is by listening to a certain segment of the United States that felt like they weren't being listened to, and listening to them very well, and then telling them what they want to hear.
Yeah, even if it's not helping them.
You know, and if you feel like you haven't been heard, like, you are going to have a oversized reaction to being heard, mm-hmm. which actually makes you a stronger, more passionate listener, which is great if you're the host of that listener, right? Like, these folks are both benefiting from and feeding the flames.
There was this interesting psychological study that I remember hearing about. I don't know if it was actually true or not, but it was something a class did to their professor. The lecture hall was split into two, basically two sides. And the people on the right side would nod aggressively and seem really sort of they would approve of everything the professor said, and then the other side would kind of cross their arms and kind of like look quizzically at the professor when he made a point. And what they found was that over the course of the year, the professor just started talking to that one side of the audience that was looking at him approvingly, and he'd even go to talk to the other side of the audience. I mean, I don't know if there's any truth to that actual study being done. Let's switch gears again here. Let's talk about Facebook shutting down recently. I guess the first question I have for you is, did you notice that people seemed a lot happier? Like, people seemed happy when it happened. What does that say? People were ecstatic in a way. They're like, that shut down. What does that say?
Well, people were happy on Twitter, which is a different social media platform, which I think is relevant. I think that people, I mean, thing is that I think, like, Facebook and Twitter, they serve different markets, let's say. And so as a consequence, you know, the kinds of people who get popular on Twitter already are adverse to Facebook, because perhaps that's where their family is and they're not really interested in communicating with those people. So yeah, I mean, but I think that I wouldn't be surprised if people, if the 5 hour or so shut down of Facebook led to a net increase of happiness more generally.
I think too, yeah, like there's like the joke on Twitter is like, who's the main character of Twitter today? And whoever it's the person who's getting canceled or whoever wrote a stupid op-ed piece and they're now the punching bag of everybody that day. And I think there's always something to those moments where you just kind of, just like anything else like we're talking about, it's like everybody kind of rallies behind this singular purpose and everybody gets to mock somebody or everybody gets to joke about, like, there was that thing, what was it, the other month when the boat got stuck in the canal?
Yeah.
And everybody on the internet's joking about it. It's like, this is just one of those moments that for a brief moment of time, the internet kind of came together and it was like, okay, this is the most important topic of discussion. Let's put aside our differences and joke about this thing. And unlike it being targeted at an individual or like a belief system, which often just doesn't result in depolarization in mass, this kind of gave it an amorphous feeling of like everything's all right for a little bit. So yeah, it was an interesting, fun day for, like Travis said, at least for people on Twitter.
All right, I got so many more questions to ask you guys. I mean, we're gonna call it here for the sake of keeping this episode from getting too long. But it's hard for me to let you guys go because it's like three of the smartest people I know on a phone call with me right now. But I'm gonna do it. Let me real quick before we close out. I didn't get to introduce Sharky. Let me just we'll get our plugs in right here. Sharky Laguana, recovering musician, CEO of Bandigo, Campago, president of the San Francisco Small Business Commission. Sharky, where can people find you?
You know, if you want to hear me say a bunch of dumb shit like I did tonight, Sharky L is my Twitter account, and that's probably the best place.
And Nathan Alabach, of the creative director of Alabach Communications. Man, I think everyone at this point, if they're not already following Steakums, they obviously should, but they should be following your account as well. Can you tell people where to find you?
Same. I mean, just my name, Nathan Alabach. That's the at for Twitter and Instagram or wherever else, Medium, I guess. Yeah. Wherever you want to find me. That's the name. So.
And you're going to send me some of your music, right?
Yes, I will send you a link to some tunes that, you know, will be at least hopefully a mediocre joy to you. So
I want to be CC'd. Thank you.
Yes. CC Sharky on that. And Travis View, host of the podcast Q Anonymous, which I really, I'm being honest, I've been listening to a ton of recently. I think it's a really great podcast and I really appreciate what you and those guys over there are doing. Can you please tell people where to find you?
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter. That's at @Travis_View. And you can listen to QAnon Anonymous on your favorite podcasting app. We recently did a two-part series on a satanic panic that happened in Northern Ireland, sort of in the middle of the Troubles, which is, I think, a really fascinating story. So, yeah, it's a fun time.
And thank you to Nadeem for help with production. Thank you to Sorry_Hat, the Twitter guy whose idea it was to get this group of people together. And that was a great idea. If you haven't already, please follow us and rate and review us at iTunes. And thank you guys so much for coming on. Can't wait to talk to you guys some more in the future.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And